TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. Chris Hedges interviews Miko Perlet, the Israeli general's son. How Israel indoctrinates its people. Miko Perlet talks about the distortions of history and why he left Israel for California. Here's Chris Hedges.
The Israeli army, known as the Israel Defense Force, or IDF, is integral to understanding Israeli society. Nearly all Israelis do 3 years of military service. Most continue to serve in the reserves until middle age. Its generals often retire to occupy senior positions in government and industry. The dominance of the military in Israeli society helps explain why war, militaristic nationalism, and violence are so deeply embedded in Zionist ideology. Israel is the outgrowth of a militarized settler colonial movement that seeks its legitimacy in biblical myth. It has always sought to solve nearly every conflict, the ethnic cleansing and massacres against Palestinians, known as the Nakba or catastrophe, in the years between 1947 and 1949, the Suez War of 1956, the 1967 and 1973 wars with Arab neighbors, the two invasions of Lebanon, the Palestinian intifadas, and the series of military strikes on Gaza, including the most recent, with violence. The long campaign to occupy Palestinian land and ethnically cleanse Palestinians is rooted in the Zionist paramilitaries that formed the Israeli state and continues within the IDF. The overriding goal of settler colonialism is the total conquest of Palestinian land. The few Israeli leaders who have sought to rein in the military, such as Israeli Prime Minister Levi Eshkol, have been pushed aside by the generals. The military setbacks suffered by Israel in the 1973 war with Egypt and Syria, and during Israel's invasions of Lebanon, only fuel the extreme nationalists who have abandoned all pretense of a liberal democracy. They speak in the open language of apartheid and genocide. These extremists were behind the 1995 assassination of Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin and Israel's failure to live up to the Oslo Accords. This extremism has now been exacerbated by the attack of October 7th, which killed about 1,200 Israelis. The few Israelis who oppose this militaristic nationalism, especially after October 7th, have been silenced and persecuted in Israel. Genocidal violence is almost exclusively the language Israeli leaders and now Israeli citizens use to speak to the Palestinians and the Arab world. Joining me to discuss the role of the military in Israeli society is Miko Perlet. Miko's father was a general in the Israeli army. Miko was a member of Israel's special forces, although disillusioned with the military, moved from his role as a combatant to that of a medic. After the 1982 war in Lebanon, he buried his service pin. He is the author of The General's Son, The Journey of an Israeli in Palestine, and Injustice, The Story of the Holy Land Foundation 5. Let's talk about you grew up, you were a child, your father was a general in the IDF. Kind of inculcation of that military ethos has begun very young and begun in the schools. Can you talk about that?
Sure. Thanks for having me, Chris. It's good to be with you again and talk to you. It begins really before the military. It begins in preschool. It begins as soon as kids are able to talk and walk. I knew the order of the ranks in the military before I knew my alphabet. And I think this is true for many, many Israeli kids. I mean, the Israeli education system is such that it leads young Israelis to become soldiers and to serve the apartheid state and to serve in the genocidal, in this genocidal, you know, state, which is the state of Israel. It's an enormous part of that. And with me, it came with, of course, you know, mega doses of that, because when your father's a general, particularly of that generation of the 1967 generals, they're like gods of the Olympus. I mean, you know, everybody knew their names. On Independence Day, I remember, like, in the schools, you would have little flags. So not just flags of Israel, but flags of the IDF with pictures of IDF generals, with pictures of, you know, military, all kinds of military symbols and so on. There's no place to develop a sense that dissent is okay, that dissent is possible. In the few cases where people do become dissenters, It's either because their families have some kind of a tradition of being communist or, you know, more progressive, and somehow it's part of their tradition. But, you know, this is a minority of a minority. By and large, Israel stands with the army, and Israel is the army. You can't really separate Israel from its army, from its military. The stories of the battles, the stories of the conquests, every city in Israel has an IDF plaza, street names after different units or different generals, or all over the country, street names of battles. So, I mean, it's everywhere. And then it wasn't until I was probably 40, or maybe just a little bit less than 40, that it was the first time that I actually encountered the other narrative, the Palestinian story. And it was unbelievable. Somebody was telling me that day is night and night is day, or the world is flat, or whatever, you know, the comparison you want to make. It was incredible. They are telling me that what I know to be true, because I heard it in school and I read it in books and I heard it from my father and from my mother and from friends, that all of this is not true. And what you find out if you go along the path that I chose to take, this journey of an Israeli into Palestine, is that it was one horrifying crime against humanity. That's what this heroism, the so-called heroism, really was. It was no heroism at all. It was a well-trained, highly motivated, well-indoctrinated, well-armed militia, which then became the IDF. But when it started, it was still a militia. Or today, they would be called a terrorist organization, that went up against the people who had never had a military force, who never had a tank, who never had a warplane, who never even prepared, even remotely for battle or for this kind of for this sort of an assault. And then you have to make a choice. I mean, how do you bridge this? The differences are not nuanced. The differences are enormous. But and again, like I said, the choice that I made is to investigate for myself and find out who's telling the truth and who isn't. And of course, my side was not telling the truth.
Large numbers of Israelis have left the country. I'm wondering how many of those are people who have a kind of conscience and are repulsed by what they have seen in the West Bank and Gaza, or perhaps I'm incorrect about that.
I don't know. I mean, the few encounters that I've had with Israelis in the U.S. over the years, the vast majority support Israel's actions. They're here for whatever reasons people come to America. You know, they're not unique. They're not necessarily because they were fed up or they were angry or they had or they were dissenters in any way, shape, or form. And I listen, you know, around D.C. and Maryland, there are many Israelis. You know, sometimes you'll sit in a coffee shop or go somewhere, you hear the conversations. You know, there's no lack of support for Israel among these Israelis, as far as I can see.
Let's talk about the army. So you were in the Special Forces elite unit. Talk about that indoctrination. I remember visiting Auschwitz a few years ago, and there were Israeli groups and people were flying Israeli flags. Speak about that form of indoctrination, its link in particular to the Holocaust.
Well, again, the myth is that Israel is the response to the Holocaust and that the IDF is the response to the Holocaust. We must be strong. We must be willing to fight. We must always, you know, have a gun in one hand, a weapon in one hand, so that this will never happen again. And what's interesting is when you talk to Holocaust survivors who are not indoctrinated, who did not get pulled into Zionism, which, you know, there are very, very many. They'll say the notion that a militarized state is somehow the answer to the Holocaust is absurd, because the answer to the Holocaust is tolerance and education and humanity, not violence and racism. But, you know, that's, again, nobody wants to ruin a good story with the facts, with a good myth, with actual facts. And of course, it's absurd. It's absolute madness. I mean, I went to serve in the army willingly, of course, as most young Israelis do. In my environment, refusing or not going was not heard of. Although there were some, you know, there were some voices, you know, in the wilderness that were refusing and so on, questioning the morality. But I never did. Nobody around me ever did until I began the training, and you began patrolling, and you're being, I think you and I may have talked about this once. I remember being given, we were an infantry unit, a commando infantry unit. And suddenly we're given batons and these plastic handcuffs, and we're told to patrol in Ramallah. And I'm going, what the hell's going on? What are we doing here? And then we're told, if anybody looks at you funny, you break every bone in their body. And I thought, everybody's going to look at us. We're commandos while marching through a city. Who's not going to look at us? I mean, what kind of a crazy... And I was just behind. I didn't realize that everybody already understood that this is how it is. You know, this is how it's supposed to be. I thought, wait, this is wrong. Why are we doing this? We're supposed to be the good guys here. So, and then, of course, the Lebanon invasion of 82 and so on. So that kind of broke that, in my mind, that was kind of a serious crack in the wall of belief and the wall of patriotism, you know, that was in me. But this whole notion that somehow being violent and militaristic and racist and being conquerors is somehow response to the horrors of the Holocaust is absolute madness. But again, when you're in it, nobody's asking the question, and nobody around you is asking questions. You don't ask questions either, unless you're willing to stand out and be smacked on the head.
You have very little criticism of the IDF, almost none within the Israeli press, although there is quite a bit of criticism right now of Netanyahu and his mismanagement and his corruption. And talk a little bit about the deification of the IDF within the public discourse and mainstream media and what that means for what's happening in Gaza.
Well, you know, the military is above the law. It's above reproach, except from time to time. So after the 73 war, there was an investigation. And now there has been, just earlier this week, there was in the cabinet meeting, the cabinet meets every Sunday, and the Army Chief of Staff was there, and he was apparently, this was leaked from the meeting, a cabinet meeting, it was leaked that some of the more right-wing partners, it's funny to say right-wing partners because they're all this right-wing, you know, lunacy in the Israeli cabinet, but the more right-wing settlers that are in the cabinet were attacking the army, were attacking the chief of staff because I guess he decided to start an inquiry because there was it was catastrophic when the Palestinian fighters came in from Gaza. There was nobody home. You know, they took over half of their country back. They took 22 Israeli settlements and cities. They took over the army base of the Gaza Brigade, which is supposed to defend the country from exactly this happening. And there was nobody in the base. You know, they took over the base. So he began, I guess, or he initiated an internal inquiry within the army, and they're criticizing him. And what you see in the Israeli press is two very interesting things. One is, yes, there was this, you know, something went horribly wrong and we need to find out why, but we should wait because we shouldn't do it during wartime. We shouldn't criticize the army during wartime. We shouldn't make the soldiers feel like they have to hold back because if they need to shoot, they should be allowed to shoot. And the other thing we see is that politically, everybody is eating each other up. I mean, they are killing each other politically in the press. So, of course, everybody that's against Netanyahu and wants a seat is attacking him. His people are attacking the others for attacking the government. I mean, it seems like there's this paralysis as a result of this infighting that is definitely affecting the functionality of the state as a state. Israel is not the state that it was prior to October 7th. You know, it was paralyzed for several weeks, and now it's still paralyzed in many ways. You've got, you know, missiles coming from the north. You've got missiles coming from the south. You've got, you know, very large numbers of Israeli soldiers being killed and thousands being injured, and the war, and it's not ending. They're not able to defeat the Palestinians in Gaza, the armed resistance and so on. So all of this is taking place, and you read the Israeli press, and it's just like the cesspool that's bubbling and bubbling and bubbling, and everybody's attacking everybody else. And the army, like you said, it's true, they are above reproach mostly, but from time to time, like I said, this particular time, the settlers are very angry because also another reason is because I guess the chief of staff, the military decided to pull back some of the ground troops, understandably, since they're being hit so hard. I remember that happening before when the army pulled back out of Gaza. They were being attacked for stopping the killing, for not continuing, you know, these mass killings of Palestinians.
How do you read what's happening in Gaza militarily?
Well, clearly the Palestinians are able to hold on and kill many Israelis. And even though the Israelis have the firepower and they've got the logistics, obviously they've got supply chains are not a problem. Whereas Palestinians, I don't know where they're getting supplies. I don't know where they're getting food even to continue fighting. They're obviously putting up a fierce resistance. I don't think that militarily there's a strategy here. I mean, this is revenge. This is just, you know, Israel was humiliated, the army was humiliated, and they needed to take it out on somebody. So they found the weakest victims they could put, lay their hands on. And these are the Palestinian civilians in Gaza. And so they're killing them by the tens of thousands. I don't think anybody believes in such a thing as getting rid of Hamas. I don't think anybody really believes that that's possible. I don't believe anybody takes seriously or actually believes that you can take 2 million people out of Gaza and spread them around the world and into other places, even though that's what they're saying. But as long as Israel is allowed to kill and as long as the supply chain isn't interrupted, they're going to continue to kill.
And they're also, of course, creating a humanitarian crisis. So it's not just the bombs and the shells, but it's now starvation, diarrhea is an epidemic, sanitation is broken. I'm wondering at what point this humanitarian crisis becomes so pronounced that really the choice is you leave or you die.
That's always the big question for Palestinians. And the sad thing is that Palestinians are always being placed in these situations where they have to make that choice. And it's the worst form of injustice. And you know this, you've been in war zones. I mean, we don't know how many bodies are buried under the rubble and what that's going to bring up. And there are hundreds of thousands now, like you said, that are suffering from all kinds of diseases as a result of this environmental catastrophe. And you remember, what was it, 2016 or something, 2017, the UN came out with a report that by 2020, Gaza would be uninhabitable. You know, I don't think the Gaza Strip has ever been inhabitable. It's been a humanitarian disaster since it was created in the early 50s, late 40s, early 50s, because they suddenly threw all these refugees there with no infrastructure, and that was it, and then began killing them. And you know, I was talking to some people the other day, you know, as Americans, as taxpayers, you know, wouldn't we want the Sixth Fleet, which is in the Mediterranean, to aid the Palestinians, to provide them support, to create a no-fly zone over these innocent people that are being massacred? I mean, as Americans, isn't that the natural, shouldn't that be the natural ask, the natural desire to demand our politicians? Because, you know, American naval vessels have been used for humanitarian causes before. Why aren't they supporting the Palestinians? Why aren't they providing them aid? Why aren't they helping them rebuild? Why is our American tax dollars going to continue this genocide rather than stop it and aid the victims? I think this is a question Americans need to ask themselves because it makes absolutely no sense. It is absolute madness that people are allowing their government to support a genocide that's not even done in secret. It's not even done in hiding. It's like it's on prime time. Everybody sees it. Everybody knows what's going on. And again, for some strange reason, Americans are allowing their military and their government to aid the genocide. And there's no question that it's genocide. I mean, the definition of the crime of genocide is so absolutely clear. Anybody can look it up and compare it to what's been going on in Palestine. So that to me is really the greatest question. Why aren't Americans demanding that the U.S. support the Palestinians?
Well, according to opinion polls, most Americans want a ceasefire. But the Congress is bought and paid for by the Israel lobby. Biden is one of the largest recipients of aid or campaign financing from the Israel lobby. And this is true within both parties. I mean, Chuck Schumer was at the rally saying no ceasefire.
Which is odd. I mean, I think ceasefire is a very small ask. And I don't know why Palestinians, we always ask for the bare minimum for Palestinians. But let's talk about ceasefire. I mean, Israeli soldiers are being killed as well in very large numbers. How has ceasefire suddenly become an anti-Israeli demand? But I think that it's a very small ask. I don't know how it was or where it was that this idea of demanding just a ceasefire came up, because that is really not a serious demand. Ceasefire gets violated by Israel anyway within 24, 48 hours. I mean, you know that, you know, historically Israel always violated ceasefires. What is required here are severe sanctions, a no-fly zone, immediate aid to the Palestinians, and stopping this and providing guarantees for the safety and security of Palestinians forever moving forward so this can never happen again. That's what really needs to be the ask. At this point, after having sacrificed so much, after having shown such what I believe is immense courage, Palestinians deserve everything. We as people of conscience need to demand not a ceasefire, we need to demand a dismantling of the apartheid state and a full stop and end, absolute end to the genocide, and guarantees put in place that Palestinian kids will be safe. I mean, I was talking to Issa Amro earlier in Hebron. I mean, it's ridiculous. You know, nobody even talks about what happens in the West Bank. Friends of mine who are Palestinian citizens of Israel, nobody dares to leave the house. Nobody dares to text. They're afraid to walk down the streets. Their safety is not guaranteed by anyone. Palestinian safety and security is left to the whims of any Israeli. And that should be the conversation right now after such horrendous violence. That needs to be the demand. That needs to be the ask when we go to protests, when we make these demands. Ceasefire, and even that, Israel is not willing. And like you said, these political supporters of Israel here in America are not willing to entertain a ceasefire. I believe it's really a crazy part of history that we're experiencing right now. And I think it's a watershed moment. I think October 7th created an opportunity to end this for good, to end the suffering of Palestinians, the oppression and the genocide for good. And if we don't take advantages, again, we being people of conscience, if we don't take advantage of this now and bring it to an end, we'll regret this for generations.
I want to talk about the shift within Zionism itself from the dominance of a secular leadership to, we see it, of course, in the government of Netanyahu, the rise of religious Zionism, which is also true now within the IDF. And I wondered if you could talk about the consequences of that.
Sure. So, you know, originally, traditionally, historically, Zionism and Judaism were at odds. And even to this day, as you know, ultra-Orthodox Jews reject Zionism and reject Israel by and large. But after 1967, there was this new creation of the Zionist religious movement. And these are the settlers that went to the West Bank, and they became the new pioneers. And they are, today, they make up a large portion of the officers and those who join the special forces and so on. And in the past, in the army, the unofficial policy was that these guys should not be, you know, they should not be allowed to advance. You know, the current chief of staff comes from that world, which is a huge change. And there are several generals and, of course, commanders, you know, high-ranking commanders and so on who come from that world. And the reason that it was the unofficial policy was that these guys should not be promoted was that, you know, it's an incredibly toxic combination. This messianic form of Judaism, which is really an aberration, it's not Judaism at all, with this nationalist, you know, fanaticism. This combination is toxic, and look what it created. It created some of the worst racists, some of the most violent thugs, you know, that we've seen, certainly in the short history of the state of Israel. Although I don't know that they're any less violent than the generation of Zionists of my father who are secular. But this was a big concern in the past, but now they're everywhere. And of course, look at the current government. They hold the finance ministry, they hold the national security ministry, certainly in the military, they're everywhere. And they hold many sub-cabinet and their heads of committees in the Knesset and so on. And they've done their work. I mean, they worked very, very hard to get to where they are today, which is where they call the shots. And they are really Netanyahu's guarantee to remain in power. You know, they're his support group. That's why you could have had, as we had earlier this year, hundreds of thousands of Israeli protesting in the streets, and it didn't affect him because he has his bloc in the Knesset. It will never leave him as long as he allows them to play their game. This is what's happening. So in terms of violence and the actual facts on the ground, I don't think these guys are any worse again than my parents' generation, who were young Zionists and zealots at the time and committed the 1948 Nakba and ran the country for the first and operated the apartheid state for the first few decades. But it's definitely a new form of fanaticism, being that it is religious as well as fascist. It's very toxic. And I think they have more of a stomach for killing civilians than we've ever seen before, even for Israelis. I mean, these numbers are just beyond, these are numbers are beyond belief, even for Israel.
I'm wondering if this religious Zionism probably has its profoundest effect within Israel in terms of shutting down dissidents, civil liberties, this kind of stuff.
Well, Israelis love them. Israelis love these guys because they're religious, but they dress like us. They don't look like the old Jews with the big beards and everything. They're kind of cool. They wear jeans. And the reason I say this is because one of their objectives is to take over Al-Aqsa and build a Jewish temple there, destroy Al-Aqsa. And so they conduct these tours. And you may know this, when you in the old city of Jerusalem, there's a particular path that you take from where the Western Wall is up to Al-Aqsa, which is open for non-Muslims. And so they hold tours, and there's several times throughout the day. And I've taken some of these tours just to see what it's about, what these guys do, you know. These are basically prayer tours. And they've taken hundreds of thousands of Israelis go on these tours. And these are Israelis who are not religious at all. These are secular people. I mean, I see the people that go on the tours. And you go up that bridge, just to give you an idea of what this is about. You go up on that bridge and then you wait until the tour starts, because you have to go in a group. And there's a massive model of the new temple, of the Jewish temple that is going to be built there. And then you have a group of armed police. They're not soldiers, they're police, but dressed like, you know, completely militarized, that accompany the tour all around. And of course, Muslim Palestinians are not allowed. They accompany the tour all around, and they stop and they pray, and they stop and they pray, and they stop and they pray at various places. The whole thing takes maybe an hour. But the interesting thing is that the people that go on these tours are secular Israelis. And then as I was doing this, I was remembering, even as a kid growing up completely secular, we would sing songs about the day that we build a temple. Thinking, why did we sing songs about building the temple? Because I think it went beyond a religious significance and it became a national significance. And there's no question in my mind that Netanyahu and secular Israelis are, you know, would love to see this idea of destroying Al-Aqsa and having a Jewish temple there. You know, it's a sign that we're back. You know, King David is back. And the connection, even though it has nothing to do with history and there's no truth in it, the connection that we are descendants of King David, you know, is something Israelis really love. That's really what this is about. So the relationship between the settlers, the so-called settlers, that's what they're called in Israeli jargon, they're called the settlers, and regular secular Israelis is an interesting one, because on the one hand, they're looked down upon because they're religious, but on the other hand, they're kind of cool religious. So there is an affinity.
Great. That was Miko Peled, author of The General's Son, The Journey of an Israeli in Palestine, and Injustice, The Story of the Holy Land, Foundation 5. I want to thank the Real News Network and its production team, Cameron Granandino, Adam Coley, David Hebden, and Kayla Rivera. You can find me at chrishedges.substack.com.
And that was the author, journalist, and former war correspondent for the New York Times, Chris Hedges. He interviewed Miko Peled on January 12, 2024. As son of one of the founding fathers of Israel, General Matti Peled, Miko was guaranteed a privileged life in Israel. You just heard some of the reasons why he left Israel and now lives in California. These were excerpts from a 43-minute interview, How Israel Indoctrinates Its People, posted on the Real News Network and also on Chris Hedges' Substack. And I urge you to support both platforms. Most of Miko Peled's interviews are posted on YouTube. Search for Miko Peled, that's MikoPeled. My name is Maria Gladden. Thank you for listening.